The United Church of God presents Bill Cowan with the sermon titled, God's Marriage Covenant. It was recorded October 12, 2013 in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
It seems that Satan, as you well know, has attacked the family, attacked everything about the family, has done an all-out blitzkrieg warfare on marriage and the sanctity of marriage, that he seems to be just totally, completely against it. He realizes that if he destroys the family, then he destroys the nation. Even the Boy Scouts have taken a long-held tradition, and they now allow open gay boys into the scouting program. We've witnessed staggering landmark decisions of homosexuality going against the sanctity of marriage, that now they can be married and can adopt children and so forth. Outside of one church, there was a marquee that listed the times of the service and the name of the pastor. And it said that the pastor would be available to do two things. Number one, to conduct the burial of the dead. And number two, to engage in the solemnization of marriage. Now that sounds foreboding. You would think, boy, I sure wouldn't want that guy to do my marriage, because, boy, you talk about not fun. You talk about somebody that's just down and out, you know. You sure wouldn't want him to perform your wedding. It'd be a dreadfully dull one, sure enough, talking about the solemnization of marriage. But, you know, now having lived through more than half of the 20th century and into the 21st century, and seeing the way that marriage has been marginalized and put down and belittled and virtually ridiculed in this day and age, I'm about ready to get on a bandwagon for, quote, solemnization of marriage, to campaign for the word solemnization of marriage. It's a good phrase because it has a lot of depth and a lot of meaning. I think the lack of the word solemnization and being solemn and realizing the significance of it, that because it's not used today in a marriage ceremony, is a contributing factor to what we witness and see around us today, the manifold chaos and problems that and confusion that is besetting marriage today. Too often people really have no idea of why they should marry, and if they do marry, they have no idea of that it really should be permanent, that it should only be temporary arrangement until perhaps something better comes along. The family is a building block of a nation, and a nation is no better than the families that comprise it. It's no stronger than the families that make it up. Our nation's in crisis. And our families are in crisis as well. More than half of all marriages now end in divorce. Confucius said, to put the world right in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must first put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must first cultivate our own personal life, and we must first set our hearts right. Men and women face many challenges today in marriage. They always have, down through the ages, but it just seems like it has culminated now in our millennium, to where it's just a staggering problem with marriages today. It's nothing new to our society, but now it's a whole lot worse. In Matthew, the 19th chapter, Jesus Christ was asked a question by the Pharisees, and it says, Matthew 19 and verses 3 through 12. Matthew 19, beginning in verse 3. The Pharisees came also to him, Christ, testing him and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And he answered and he said unto them, Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And he said, For this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh. And so in verse 6 then, they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, what God hath joined together, let not man put a separate. And then in verse 7, well, they said unto him, Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning, that's not what God intended. From the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whosoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whosoever marries her that is divorced commits adultery. And his disciples in verse 10, they didn't understand. And they said, If such is the case, a man with his wife, then it's better not to marry. And he said unto them, All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were made born, and thus from their mother's womb. And there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And he who is able to accept it, let him accept. Around 440 years ago, before the coming of Jesus Christ to this earth, Malachi, the prophet, was calling his generation to account for their lack of faithfulness. He said that they were a faithless people, that they had broken faith one with another. Notice Malachi 2 and verse 10 and how they did this. Malachi 2 and verse 10, last book of the Old Testament in the King James order. Malachi 2 and verse 10, it talks about the treachery of infidelity. Have we not all one Father, and has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers? What covenant of the fathers? He's going to get into that in a moment. Verse 11, Malachi 2 and verse 11. Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution. What holy institution? Which he loves, talking about the marriage institution, and said that Judah profaned the marriage institution, the holy marriage institution, which God loves. Do you realize that God loves marriage? And hopefully he loves your marriage, that you have that type of marriage. And he says that he then has profaned that because he has married the daughter of a foreign god. Marriage is an institution that God loves. It's an institution that he created. It is an institution that he ordained. It is an institution that he loves. Marriage is a beautiful, fantastic, and wonderful thing. But Malachi said they had broken faith by marrying the daughters of foreign gods. So instead of staying faithful to the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob that they knew, they sought wives from other worshipers, other religions, and had become deluded and no longer stayed focused on the true God and serving him as they should. They had departed from God's law. They had forsaken his way of life. And Malachi points out that they had manifested their faithlessness by breaking faith and not staying true to their marriage partners. It's clear from the passages that we read here that they had not forsaken, quote, religion, end quote. They had not given up on religiosity, or they had not given up on religious activity and religious service. But they find that despite all the tears, all of the crying, all of the crying out and protest and religiosity, God did not seem to be pleased nor satisfied with their worship and the offerings that they brought. In verse 13, And this is the second thing he said, Malachi 2 and verse 13. This is the second thing that you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears and with weeping and crying. Oh, they come and they make this show and they do all of this and that. And so he does not regard the offering anymore nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. And they ask the question, why? Why is it that when we come before God to worship, it's just not there? Why is it that we do not have a sense of immediate contact with God in the presence of God? We're going through the motions. We're doing the, quote, religious things. We seem to hallow God, and yet our worship seems hollow and shallow and empty and without real substance. And, of course, the answer is they're sins. That your sins, that my sins, that the nation's sins is what separates us and creates a barrier between us and God. Verse 14, and yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. And yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. God stands over and presides over your marriage. He sees you. He sees your mate. He sees all that goes on behind closed doors. He knows and recognizes all too often that, sadly, the situation behind the closed doors is not all well. Even though they're one flesh, even though he or she is your partner, some have broken faith with their partner and have disestablished your marriage covenant. And Malachi says in verse 16, for the Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garments with violence, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. So God loves marriage, but he hates divorce. He says it's treachery to violate this marriage covenant, the marriage vows and the marriage agreement. And for those of you that have been through it, realize that you can see why God says he hates divorce. For those of you that have been through the absolute trauma and heartache, the emotional experience and the devastation that you go through with a divorce, you too can shake your head and say, yeah, I sure see why God hates it. I hate it too. It was horrible. One of the worst experiences I've ever been through in my life. They say that death is of a loved one is the hardest thing to go through. And second is divorce. Because with death, finally, you might reach some, you know, closure. But with divorce, it's like it's just that burr under your saddle constantly. Marriage is a covenant where a man and a woman commit themselves one to another for life. And it's based on solemn vows that they become one. They don't become one and then make vows. They make vows, and because of this covenantal, this contractual agreement that they go through with each other, then they become one emotionally, hopefully spiritually, intellectually, sociologically, and physically. And it's not just the isolation of the physical part, or the expression or the sexual union that makes the relationship, but it is the whole thing, not just the sex part, because if that's all that's involved, then that makes a monstrosity of the whole event, because it's built within the framework of the covenantal relationship, one with another, and that is a vital part of it. But when we conduct a marriage ceremony, we come before God and we ask for his presence, asking him to join together a man and a woman, a husband and wife, as one in a unique relationship before him. Marriage is a special and unique God-ordained relationship. Marriage is God's idea. It's not man's idea. It's God's idea. It's not a concept devised by human beings. It is God's institution. It's God that established the marriage covenant in Genesis, the second chapter, with Adam and Eve. And in marriage, we ask God to set apart, to sanctify the couple, signifying the wonderful spiritual union between Christ and His church. Therefore, it's not to be entered into lightly, because it is something that is very solemn, or carelessly, but rather very thought out with reverence for God and with due consideration for the purposes and the principles on which God founded and established marriage. A perspective on marriage that was written several centuries ago, I'm not sure where this came from, but I thought it was interesting. It says, couples used to swear in marriage their betrothals and allegiances before each other and before God, rendering all marriages a party agreement, with God being a third party in the marriage union. And as a third party and witness and judge, the couple's parents then acted as God's lieutenants and guardians for their children, and they gave their consent to the union. Two witnesses, as God's police on their peers, served as witnesses to the marriage, and the minister holding God's spiritual power of the word blessed the couple and admonished them in their spiritual duty. And the magistrate holding God's temporal power of the sword registered the couple, protecting their personal property, their persons and their property. And each of those were involved in the marriage covenant, and each of these parties are considered essential to the legitimacy of the marriage. They each represent a different dimension of God's involvement in the covenant. To omit any such party was in effect to omit God from the marriage covenant. Marriage is a serious thing to God, something not to be viewed lightly, something not to just be entered into. It was something that in days of old, as I just read, was really thought to be holy and sanctimonious and so forth. Marriage was once viewed in the United States of America as a, quote, holy union. Even the United States Supreme Court spoke repeatedly of marriage not simply as a contract, but as a godly ordinance, quote, unquote, and, quote, a divine covenant, quote, unquote, and, quote, a sacred obligation, end quote. And that's from the Supreme Court. And of course, today, people ridicule that type of thing. People today don't seem to view marriage in that context at all. Instead of seeing marriage as a tri-party agreement and a covenant where God is the witness to what is said, the couple see marriage as simply a convenience or a custom of mankind. And as a result, then man came up with it. Therefore, man can alter it, and man can do anything that they want. You don't have to stay married. Couples today see marriage as simply a convention that's to be adopted. In other words, it's not a created ordinance of God, established by God, that was created before society was ever even established. But it's viewed as just a human ordinance to make living together, quote, legal, end quote. Couples today do not believe marriage has divine sanctification or divine mandate. They have no idea where it came from. We've sunk into depravity so far to the extent that now we even allow homosexuals to marry in our nation. That's an abomination to God. Even heterosexual couples think that it's just an idea that someone in the past came up with, and so they could live together and make babies. That's the only purpose they think that it's for. And they think it's just something, an institution that mankind dreamed up and therefore can be revamped or changed by man. In other words, it's not a divinely created ordinance. It is a humanly devised experiment. And so if young people today grow up thinking that it's just a humanly devised experience, then they think that if it doesn't, you know, the experiment, if the experiment doesn't work, then you just walk away from it at any time you want to. They simply can turn the lights off in the lab and say, well, that experiment didn't work, and go home. After all, it was just a human experiment, and it didn't work. So now let me find another laboratory and let me try another experience or experiment. They think that marriage is just an encumbrance or a hangover from our past. And because they've taken the law of God and they've turned it upside down and engaged in one flesh relations prior to the union of a marriage, then they feel pressured by society to simply fulfill what they feel like is just, get married in order to, quote, legalize their mating habits. And so marriage then simply becomes a legalized form of sexual exploration. That's not marriage. Physical union is not, it is a constitute part of, obviously, marriage. But physical union itself is not marriage. Physical union does not create a marriage. Young people today say why they got married. They'll say, oh, Grandma was coming from New Jersey, and Grandma's all upset because I just live with Bob, and so we just did it. We just did it. We decided we'd just do it, and it doesn't matter. After all, it's just a piece of paper from the courthouse. And that's what it means to, sadly, so many young people today. I'm thankful that that's not what it means to Rod and Emily. And you might as well have a free agency clause written in there that if he or she doesn't do such and such, then you're, you know, after 2 or 3 years, then you can just split. You can just walk out and that's it. And you don't have any hassle or liability or anything like that. Marriage today is kind of an annual renewable contract, so to speak. And if you view marriage just as a convenience or a custom or a consequence or a convention or a tradition, then you're going to have to surround yourself with all types of things to protect yourself. You've got to have the mechanism there to protect yourself. And that's why they have all these prenup clauses and all this and that, just in case he or she doesn't meet up to your expectations of what you are expecting. And you see then why many people think of marriage as just a trap, that it's just a cage or something to hedge people in, and that it's just something that really stifles an individual. And a lot of people think, well, boy, I'm going to avoid that at any and all cost. Society believes more and more that marriage does not suit us anymore, that it has become passé, that it's afterlife, and so forth, and that it just traps people, and it distorts people, and so forth. Jill Sweeney said in the Guardian newspaper, said, outside the bonds of a Christian marriage, we may find out what love is all about. No, we won't. That's a lie. That is an absolute out-and-out lie. You will not find out what love is all about outside, quote, the Christian marriage. You might discover what abject lust is. You might find out what total, complete selfishness is. But you will not find out what the nature of self-giving sacrifice and love is truly all about. God's blueprint for marriage calls for an exclusive relationship between one man and one woman into a covenant for life. A covenant is vastly different from a simple contract. where either party might just decide, well, that didn't work and I'm sorry, let's just, you know, leave it at that, and they can change their mind on any given whim and so forth. But it's a covenant. And for your homework, I want you to read Genesis, the 15th chapter. I went through a sermon here several weeks ago about the various covenants in the Bible, and I covered this particular one. But I want you to read about a very sober scene and serious occasion involving a dramatic encounter between God and Abraham. There was deep darkness. There's a presence of death. There's a burning lamp, bright burning. And we find the cutting of animals in two, and they were cut in two and then laid one on one side of one part and the other on the other side, and then they walked through those animals, implying that if I do not live up to the covenant that I have agreed to, may God rend me asunder, may I be cut in two, because it was a very, very serious thing to God to enter a covenantal relationship. And when young people marry today, the important thing is not how you feel, but the important thing is that you made promises, you make vows, and you make a covenant between you, your mate, and your God. Because if you rely strictly on just, quote, feelings to keep going on the proper side, you may or may not fall off the edge. But if you make vows, then that puts a hedge of protection around you and around your marriage, and protects you and your mate and your marriage. Couples full of enthusiasm and love sometimes want to have their, quote, own vows, end quote. And generally, that is a big, big mistake. Because God is the one that sets the parameters for marriage. But I can just see, you know, you ask them to join hands and accept the sacred marriage covenant imposed by God, and all of a sudden he speaks up and he says, "Oh, Penelope, he said, the first time I ever saw your face, the earth moved in my hands." And you say, "Whoa, whoa, wait a minute, this is not the honeymoon. This is, you know, this is a covenant. This is an agreement that we make with God, between you and God. This is a marriage. This is a tri-party relationship between three individuals, the husband, the wife, and God." And so we don't let Roberta Flack write our marriage vows for us. That is God. It's promises that we make. It's covenants that we make with God. It's not about feelings. Sure, there are feelings involved. But it's about promises and things that we say that we're going to do. It's about vows. And this is about better or worse in sickness and in health until death do us part. This is intellectual, not emotional. Now, certainly there is emotion involved in it, and it should be. But if we base it strictly on emotion, you may or may not even get out of the limousine, you know, before you change your mind and are ready to pitch her or him and dump her and go on your way. And you may not even make it through the photographs with your, quote, husband or wife if it's just based on emotion. You have to make vows. You have to establish a covenant. This is a contractual, covenantal arrangement and agreement between you, your mate, and God. Three parties involved in this covenant. It's not about your feelings or your emotions. These are vows, not sentiments. Promises, not emotions. Covenants, not feelings. No wonder marriages don't last any longer today when they expect Roberta Flack to write their vows for them. In the marriage ceremony that we go through several scriptures about the sanctity of marriage I won't read all of that, of course, but let me just read the short section of the exchange of vows. I'll just read one of them, his. The woman's is a little bit different, but basically the same. It says, because marriage is a divine institution and we're asking God to join you as husband and wife, it is fitting and right that each of you should faithfully promise before God to accept the sacred marriage covenant according to the divinely ordained conditions established by Almighty God. Do you then, and you ask their name, faithfully promise, or you give their name, faithfully promise and covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses to take the other to be your lawful wedded wife or husband in sickness and in death, in good times and in difficult times, for as long as you both shall live, to love her, cherish her, honor her, and provide for her. And so then, since all ordinations, once you go through his and then hers, and since all ordinations are setting apart in the scriptures by the laying on of hands, would you please join your right hands, and with the laying on of my hands, I will ask the eternal God to unite you as husband and wife. That's some pretty serious stuff. It goes beyond a contract. It goes beyond feelings. It goes and supersedes emotions. It sounds so often so awesome, and it sounds so serious. And yes, it is the solemnization of marriage. As far as people's approach to marriage, they might as well today just to go ahead and sign their names on the back of Kellogg's cereal box, Frosted Flakes or whatever, and then run off into the night, because it basically means no more to them than that. But in marriage, we enter a covenant of companionship. I will be your partner, you be my partner throughout life, and a companion through life. Marriage is a covenantal agreement to meet and fulfill the other spouse's needs for companionship on every level: physically, sexually, emotionally, psychologically, socially, spiritually, intellectually, and etc. On every level for the rest of your life. It is, therefore, a final act. When you marry, you agree to stay married until, quote, death do us part. We're to grow together as companions on the journey of life, maintained by the covenantal commitment one to another. Even though challenges on every side of flow and circumstance, and you're tempted by maundering sights and influences all around today, our relationship is protected by means of that covenant, by means of those vows, and enabled by God that we stay on track. It is a result of this companionship that men and women become one. You don't have to live under the threat of divorce. You have a covenant. The binding nature of that divine covenant is lifelong and assures them that divorce is not an option. It is a wonderful difference that a Christian possesses: a covenant, an agreement of a lifetime commitment. But in our nation today, statistics show that even in the, quote, Christian, end quote, community, that divorce is pretty much the same percentage as others. Evangelical Christians, quote, unquote, have a higher divorce rate than others. So in a marriage covenant, a man and a woman are joined together in a unique relationship that's unlike any other human relationship that is known to mankind. A relationship that goes deeper than any other relationship. It's not a tenuous relationship. It's not something based on eggshells. It's not something that may be forsaken at will. It involves legalities. It involves commitment. It involves vows. It involves living up to those vows and to the promises that you make. And because it is a covenantal agreement, no matter what comes along, you stick it out through sickness and in health. We've seen wives that have watched their mate's vigor and vitality corrode, eaten away with Alzheimer's, are spending the last 10 out of a 22-year marriage taking care of a paraplegic due to a horrible accident that he went through, cutting his food, placing his glass just in the right place so that you can put the straw in his mouth so that he may be able to drink. That's commitment. That's love. That's living up to the vows. Yet in recent surveys of, quote, Christian homes, 75% of these, quote, Christians thought that divorce was a reasonable solution to problem marriages. Three-fourths of them said that it was okay. It's frightening to realize how that the heart and the nature of our society has bled into the realm, even of, quote, the Christian church, and an all too often even into our own church. Perhaps it's even bled over into our way of thinking as well. Absolutely, there are times when divorce is the only situation. Certainly a woman should not remain in physical abuse in a relationship where he hits her or something like this, and a few other issues. But all too often, despite vows that are made, divorce is a convenient way, quote, to get rid of a problem, end quote. In clear contrast to the type of thinking, the way to live in marriage and the way to handle problems, handle issues and solve issues and settle issues in marriage, is to clearly define up front at the beginning that you have a contract, that you have a covenant bound by God, and that you are willing to work it out. Not bail out, not jump out, work it out. That divorce is not an option. That you are entering into a deal that in case things don't go according to your plans, you cannot slip out the side door. Not like a runaway truck coming down Mont Eagle, and they have these ramps built off the side that if he's run away, then he can just go off into the sand and slowly stop. God didn't build that clause and runaway ramp into marriages and runaway lives and runaway marriages, except for a couple exceptions. And there are those exceptions. But definitely not my place to try to cover those exception clauses. Quite the opposite. At best, God hates divorce and the agony and frustration that it causes. I wish young people understood these things before they say I do. I wish they had an absolute understanding, because we see today teenagers and so forth that I just absolutely hurt for. Here's some today's role models in marriages: Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovett, married for 21 months. Charlie Sheen and Donna Peel, married for 14 months. Jennifer Lopez and Chris Judd, married for 7 months. Pamela Anderson and Kid Rock, married for 5 months. Renee Zellweger and Kenny Chesney, married for 4 months. Nicolas Cage and Lisa Marie Presley, married for 4 months. Drew Barrymore and Jeremy Thomas, married for 6 weeks. Carmen Electra and Dennis Rodman, married for 9 days. And Dennis Hopper and Michelle Phillips, married for 8 days. And the grand prize winner of all, Britney Spears and Jason Alexander, married for 55 hours. And we need to urge our young people to make sure they stick with marriage, that it is a covenant, that it is an agreement, that it is something that we are to certainly live by and to stick by, not something that is to be just passé or passed off or whatever. But we need to urge them to live in purity and in marriage and fidelity during their marriage, that they may know the joy and the freedom and the fullness that comes from God's way of marriage and a commitment to the divinely imposed vows that they gave. When you break the vows, it breaks hearts. And when hearts are broken, marriages are broken. And we need to be teaching young people about the submission to the design of God, of what God has planned and outlined for marriage, for the marriage covenant, and to be wholeheartedly 100% representing it and so forth. When a couple gets married, to most are, quote, in love, end quote, and it's inconceivable to them that they might have problems. They're bursting with all kinds of desires and feelings and hormones and love, and they're anxious to be able to express that love one to another, the romantic feelings and so forth. And that's fantastic. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. But when the couple's out in the outback of Soddy Daisy and the rent has not been paid and the electricity is cut off, and there's no money for the baby's milk, and it's a cold, rainy day outside, that's when everything coming down around their head, that's when those vows really kick in. Marriage is beautiful. Marriage is wonderful. Marriage is fantastic. It's such a protection. It is such a shelter. It's a hedge built around a couple to protect them from infidelity. It's a couple to protect them from venereal disease and divorce and so many unpleasant things. Vows that are put to put the other person's interest above their own selfish interest. It is the freedom of a lifetime commitment. The freedom of marrying a believer in the Lord. Freedom of a husband's joy of putting his wife's desires first. A freedom of a wife's fulfillment of becoming husband-oriented in all that she does. The freedom that comes as a result of having rejected divorce and accepting the divinely ordained vows that they commit to. I'm not sure where this came from. But let me read this. It says, in their commitment to the unity of marriage, the couple promises to be faithful to each other if poverty and disease should come upon them. They vow before God and man to be faithful. If a man meets a more attractive and more intelligent and more compassionate person, he has vowed to be faithful. The wife vows to be faithful to her husband. If he loses his high-paying job, his esteem before men, his mental faculties or his youthful vigor, she commits to him even when he doesn't measure up to the standard God has set for him, even when he doesn't love her as Christ loved the church. The husband vows to be faithful even though his wife loses her beauty, her charm, or her tenderness. His commitment remains steadfast even though she is unsubmissive, disrespectful, and unable to manage the household well. Through it all, the two will remain one flesh. That's quite a statement. That's the description of a biblical marriage. I hope that it makes all of us stop and think about the covenantal relationship that we are currently in, because I think it's worth a lot of time and a lot of effort that we should be putting into our marriages. That we put a lot of commitment behind it. It's better not to vow than to make vows and then not fulfill those vows. Marriage is a result of companionship that men and women become one, intellectually, emotionally, physically, spiritually, sexually, every way they become one. In some cases, they even begin to look like each other. And that is a horrible, horrible, distressing prospect for Betty. In a marriage covenant, it's not the way we feel that's important. You act the way you do because you focus on fulfilling your vows. It's not a matter of having your needs met. It's not a matter of what I need or what I want or what I desire. It is a matter of what I can give to fulfill my vows. In a marriage covenant, you promise to be their companion, even though it goes this way or that way or whatever way. I will remain with you. I will be faithful to you. I will love you. I will protect you and definitely, deeply love and honor you. You did not enter into a contract whereby one or the other could just decide that they are tired or they want out. If he or she doesn't fulfill certain requirements written or required by you, then you're just going to bail ship and you're not going to continue with your side of the bargain. No, it's a covenant, and it is the focus. Your focus of life should be there. That, and that then gives you tremendous freedom. It gives you tremendous blessings and opportunities. You don't have to live every day under the fear of divorce, because divorce is not an option. You don't have to worry about adultery, because you made a covenant. You made an agreement, and this will be the only one in your life. It's not an option. It's a covenant. A covenant of life and a covenant of death. There was a Beatles song. It said, when I get old and losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine or birthday greeting, a bottle of wine? If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Would you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? The answer is yes. She may be waiting behind the door with an 8-iron or a rolling pin, but she's behind the door. She made vows, and she vowed that she would be there. He comes home because he made vows that he would come home, that he would be there. He comes back through the door because he promised that. You make a covenant to come back. Neither party bails out at the first sign of difficulty. Divorce is not an option. Divorce was not something that was already planned in their head. Well, if this doesn't work out the way that I want it to work out, then I'm out the door. Some of you have broken vows, perhaps some on many different occasions and maybe in many different ways. Though this is not the thought that I'm trying to get across in this sermon today, but God can forgive. Possibly your mate can forgive you. And by chance, you might even possibly forgive yourself. And perhaps then that tri-party agreement can be reestablished. That covenant can come back. Damaged, yes, but hope for the future is there if you don't bail out. What is a successful marriage? I don't know the best definition, because it's just basically two clumsy, bumbling sinners that are stuck together as a loving companion in a sacrificial relationship before God, which takes place in the life, in the face of life's crisis and problems. Randy Travis had a song that said, "On the Other Hand," and it's about a man on a business trip that meets an attractive lady, and he says to himself, "On the one hand, we could easily spend the evening together without a great deal of difficulty. But on the other hand, there's a golden band that reminds me of someone who wouldn't understand. So while on this hand we could do this, the reason I have to go is on the other hand." What's on the other hand? Is it a surveillance system? Is it some kind of a chain? No. What is there is a symbol, not just of feelings, but of a covenant, of vows, which if we break them, then we do so at our own peril, and we suffer the dreaded impact of all concerned. Here's a letter from a 28-year-old lady, and she said, "I grew up in an unstable non-Christian home. I've had 5 parents and 3 sets of siblings. My mother just called me this past Sunday to inform me that she was about to bestow upon me a sixth parent and a fourth set of siblings. I understand in the very depth of my being why God hates divorce and why we should too. No good thing comes from it ever. Divorce has not only stolen from me a family, but also the grapes that my parents ate with relish have set my teeth on edge. Divorce answers no questions, solves no problems, resolves no conflict, gives no respite, restores no dignity, and grants no peace. Divorce cannot be dealt with too harshly, especially in the Church of Jesus Christ. I bless God that He knows divorce in the marriage covenant that He has established. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread that. It says, I bless God that He knows no divorce in the marriage covenant that He established between Himself and His bride. And we must teach husbands and wives to honor the covenant that they made before God, if for no other reason than for the sake of the next generation. When marriages are founded just on feelings and physical attraction, when the feelings are gone and when the ravages of time and gravity have done their dirty work, then the chance of making a go of it is slim, if that's the only reason they married. But when marriages are founded and grounded in friendship and companionship with an awe-inspiring awareness of an unending covenant, no matter what, then the possibilities of survival are greatly increased. This sermon is not intended to make anybody feel bad or to put anybody down because you've been divorced, because statistically speaking, half of you sitting here are divorced. And I think you could stand up and better than anyone else and say to the young people and to those that are contemplating marriage how stupid divorce is, but how important it is to make the right decision to begin with. There's not my point or purpose at all, like I said, to make anybody feel bad. But that each one then should be thankful that God is loving and that God's great mercy and forgiveness, and that we can truly put the past behind us and have it forgiven. And my point was not to discuss divorce and remarriage or the clauses as what's bound and what's not bound and so forth. No, rather my purpose is to focus on a relationship to those that are currently married or contemplating marriage or those who hope to marry in the future, for all to realize the seriousness, the solemnization of the marriage ceremony, of our vows and our commitment and our covenant between us, our mate, and our God. A cutting of the covenant until death do us part. Now that I have completely terrified Rod and Emily and every single in the audience and all the young people, let me say this. Marriage is the greatest physical blessing that you can have in this life. There is nothing better physically than having one good, happy marriage. The richest man, I guess, that has lived in my lifetime, I don't know if Bill Gates or somebody in Saudi Arabia or something is more wealthy, but that I have at least heard of in my lifetime was J. Paul Getty. And J. Paul Getty made the statement that he would be willing to give all of his billions of dollars for one happy marriage. And you sitting here today have an opportunity to be richer than one of the richest men that's ever lived. Seize that opportunity. If you're married, work at it. Ecclesiastes, the 9th chapter, in verses 9 and 10. Ecclesiastes 9 in verse 9. Says, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given to you under the sun, all the days of your vanity, for this is your portion in life. That's it. That's the ultimate physical thing that you can obtain. And in this labor which you perform under the sun. And then very interestingly, a verse that we quote quite often out of context, the next verse in verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work nor device nor knowledge nor wisdom in the grave where you're going. Your marriage is the greatest portion of this life. It's a wonderful thing. It's a joyful thing. It's an exciting thing that marriage should be. Having a happy marriage is the number one reward that we have in this physical life. Do you think maybe we should be working a little more on our marriages? Do you think maybe we ought to be spending a little bit more time and energy and effort really making a marriage good and profitable and enjoyable, submitting yourselves one to another? Do you think it might be worth a staggering investment of time and energy to be able to fulfill the number one blessing of this physical life? The vows are very important. They summarize the commitment that is involved, and they are walls of protection around your marriage. When the winds and the waves begin to beat upon the house, we have an abiding responsibility to live in faithfulness to those vows that we make in front of God, asking God as a third part and a third party to our vows, and covenant to bind together as one flesh. They did ask you earlier, Mr. Holliday mentioned, to please clear the hall pretty rapidly. They want to set up some things and take the things from your seats. But I want to close by reading words to a beautiful song. It goes like this. Faithful heart, what more can one life ask? One hand to hold along life's past, share with me this vow. For all times our souls will be entwined. I give this love, I live this love. No greater joy is mine. Storms will come, but we will never part. For each of us bequeathed a faithful heart.